In 2007, the Babylon podcast was our last best hope for more Lost Tales. We thought it failed. But after WonderCon, it became something more. Our last best hope for more Lost Tales geeking. The year is 2008. The name of the show is the Babylon Podcast. And welcome back to another Babylon Podcast. I am Summer Brooks.
I am Tim Callender.
Aloha! It's Jeffrey back on terra firma mainland.
Returned from Hawaii to grace us with his well-tanned, well-rested presence.
Voilons look very good with a deep, rich, copper-toned tan, I'm telling you.
Is that a tiki god in your pocket, or are you just wearing the shower curtain too tight?
Oh, that's so wrong. Funny, but wrong.
Hey, look, I've got a couple of things, and mm-hmm. This is going to be all about me, but it does pertain to Babylon 5 to a certain extent. First of all, I discovered that Bruce Boxleitner and I share a birthday.
Really?
May 12th.
Happy birthday, Bruce and Tim. Happy birthday, Bruce and Tim. Or should it be Tim and Bruce?
No, we'll let him go first because he's the older of the two.
This year.
By like a
he's
year,
the older
right?
brother. The other thing is, while Jeffrey was sunning himself, I happened to be in Vegas for a business trip. Now, I would not condone anyone going to Vegas of their own volition, but if you're there, I highly recommend, especially if you're a Star Trek fan, going to Star Trek The Experience.
Oh.
And I got to see George Johnson's work on Borg Invasion.
Nice.
It was very, very well done. Okay, spoiler alert. Okay, here you go. So if you want to go to this thing and not have, you know, and experience it without my input, then skip forward about 5 minutes. Here's the deal. The whole shtick is that you and 20 of your other closest friends are kind of herded into this room, and you find yourself on Copernicus Station, and the holographic doctor is telling you that you all have shown resistance to the Borg nanoprobes. They want to run more tests, and of course, the Borg attack. And this is very well done. They integrate the pre-filmed material with the live actors very nicely. And of course, as they're herding you to the shuttle to escape from Copernicus Station, the Borg show up and they tell you, of course, you know, don't respond. If they don't perceive you as a threat, they won't attack. They get you on the shuttle, and this is where they give you the optical protection goggles, which are basically 3D glasses, right? And this is where Mr. Johnson's work shows up. Because then, of course, the Borg have got you your shuttle captured. And all of a sudden, all of these Borg probes are, like, waving in your face. Okay? Like, coming up to your eye, the whole nine yards. And then they jab you in your back and your butt with needles or something out of your seat. Everybody in the room screamed. Lady sitting next to me grabbed my hand. So they had these things poking into you, which is just creepy anyway. And all this stuff waving in your face in 3D. It was very, very effective. And then, of course, at the end, it was good. And then, of course, at the end, Voyager shows up with Admiral Janeway, and they fight off the Borg. And that thing coming at you in three dimensions is pretty damn cool because it's really huge. It's filling up the screen, and it fills up your vision. It was a lot of fun. It was a lot of fun. Like I say, highly recommended.
So, would it have been as cool if it was in a calmer environment, say Branson, Missouri, rather than drunken Las Vegas?
No, because it was basically nothing but Star Trek fans wandering around. They were all very sober, except the fact that everybody had pretty much this geeky fanboy grin on their face the mm-hmm. whole time. I got my picture taken in the captain's chair.
Mm. Cool.
Nice.
It was
nice.
Really cool. It was the coolest thing ever. So,
are you
going to
share that picture?
I can do that. I can post that up.
That would be good.
Yep. Me and my Starfleet regulation shorts and sneakers.
Peter, in Peter from Norway, our good friend Warlord, sent me a link in email to a Flickr photo album of his. He has cutouts, you know, the stand-up life-size cutouts of the... He's got Jakar, he's got Ivanova, he's got Garibaldi.
Wow.
He's got Sheridan. He's got Londo. And there's he's just like cardboard people up against... I'm sitting here, dude, how did you do that?
Where did you get them?
Where he and, oh, that would just be kind of cool. And so my question for Jeffrey is, do you know if they ever did a Kosh one?
A Kosh stand-up? No. Mm-hmm. I don't believe so, no.
Darn.
No.
Because then I could tease him about not having a complete collection, and he'd go find one.
Yeah, right.
He would.
Well, see, the thing is, the actor in the costume did such a cardboard job of acting.
Oh.
Very two-dimensional, huh?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Oh.
Come on, Jeffrey. You know I love you. You're the best Kosh ever.
That's just wrong.
Yeah. Pedal as fast as you can. So I have a little interesting update on a new show that I'm working on, and I can tell you a little bit about it because the first part of this is already aired. So I'm coming on to season two, and it has a B5 tie-in that I thought I should share.
Mm-hmm.
A very dear friend of mine is now an executive producer on a show called Celebrity Rehab on VH1. Mm. And while I was in Hawaii, he begged and pleaded with me to join him for a short stint on Celebrity Rehab Season 2. And so I've just begun the work on that process and on that project. And what I... had to do on my first day was to watch all of season one because I had never seen the show and was actually fairly concerned that it was a fairly cheesy reality show. And I sat down and watched 8 straight hours of Celebrity Rehab, which chronicles people as they go through their drug and alcohol recovery program and treatment with Dr. Drew Pinsky. And season one included the patients. Among the patients was my good friend Jeff Conaway from Babylon 5. And it was emotional and heart-wrenching and inspiring and beautiful and tragic, all wrapped up into the same thing. And now that I have had just a quick peek at the behind the scenes of how the show goes together, I can tell you there is no contriving anything. There's no manipulating the patients. There's, you know, Dr. Drew is a serious doctor, and the program is very serious, and the cameras are truly fly on the wall. There's no manipulation. It is true reality, and so that just changed my mind about the whole thing. I'm very excited to be on the show because I can see how important, you know, this is the sort of stuff that really is television that matters, because hopefully through these patients' experiences, other people will learn and benefit and be able to take care of themselves. But for those of, you know, the listeners who had seen Jeff go through all he went through, you know, just my hearts and prayers are with Jeff all the time. I hope he continues to take care of himself.
Yeah, so do we.
I'm glad to find out that, because I know some people were wondering how much of it was staged, and I'm glad to have your insight on it, that was them really truly going through some tough times and getting through it.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, there's
nothing to say.
Yeah, nothing more to say about that, sure.
Well, yeah.
Jeffrey, we're glad that you feel like you're doing work that has value. That's important, too.
Well, I always have, and I was, you know, I was very hesitant to even get on this project until my friend Evan convinced me that this was, you know, a worthy cause and television that matters, and that's important. So,
good.
So there we go. That's my little B5 drop in the bucket for today.
All right.
Okay.
Well, Summer, what do you think? Take a break?
Yep.
Do some geeking?
Yes, we will take a short break and come right back with some deep geeking on the episode, Whatever Happened to Mr. Garibaldi?
On the next Babylon 5, Jakar's desperate mission leaves him at the mercy of his enemy.
There's a reward for his capture. Dead or alive?
Which pays the most?
Now, he must bargain for his life.
It would be torture for a very long time.
On the next...
Does this please you?
Babylon 5.
The President of the United States is dead. He was murdered in the morning sunlight by a 4-year-old boy. So began J.C. Hutchins' Seven Son Patio Book Trilogy, the most popular podcast novel series in history. Last December, the trilogy concluded. The heroes were triumphant, or so we think. But now, it's time to go back and reveal moments in the Seventh Son story that were merely hinted at in the original trilogy. Welcome to Seventh Son Obsidian. J.C. Hutchins has opened up his Seventh Son universe and invited the seven biggest names in podcast fiction to chronicle a nationwide blackout that rocked America during the Seventh Son trilogy. Seventh Son Obsidian features short stories from these award-winning and nominated authors: Michael A. Stackpole, Scott Sigler, T. Morris, Mer Lafferty, Matt Wallace, Mark Yoshimoto Nemkov, and Christiana Ellis. And even more tales from these trailblazing podcast entertainers: Evo Terra, Dan Klass, Wichita Rutherford, George Probb, TD0013, Soccer Girl, and the cast of The Radio Adventures of Dr. Floyd. Obsidian also features dozens of audio and video recordings, stories of the blackout as told by its victims, created by Seventh Son fans across the globe. On May 31st, the lights go out. America becomes a police state. Because when the power fails, chaos reigns. Subscribe now to Seventh Son Obsidian, or catch up with the original Seventh Son trilogy experience at jchutchins.net.
Digging down into the most obscure facts in fandom, this is B.E.
And we are back with our geeking, continuing on along the layered season. Four.
Yes.
I don't know. What would you call that? Multiple layers? Multiple just compressed time?
It's funny because I watched this episode twice today, and the episode we're geeking is Whatever Happened to Mr. Garibaldi. And one of the things, amongst many things that really struck me about it, is this episode especially really, I think, sets the tone for season four, but also completely changes the show itself.
Oh, really?
I think so. I think it becomes, that almost is a hallmark of Babylon 5. Every year, it almost reinvents itself. But this one is, in the first three seasons, it was pretty much self-contained.
Mm-hmm.
Partially, obviously, due to production restraints, it's set on the station. But everything that everybody does impacts that core group of characters, if you will. Okay? With whatever happened to Mr. Garibaldi, all of a sudden, everybody's going off in different directions. And these are logical directions. These are, nothing's arbitrary. But I think it does, I think it becomes a different series.
I don't actually see it as people going off on their own. Not in quite the wide expanse that you seem to imply there, but yeah, Londo has to deal with stuff at home. And naturally, he brings Veer in on it. Later on, as we'll see, Jakar ends up there. So it actually becomes a story that's split into two different locations, but I don't see it as everyone going off on their own. Not till later.
Well, yeah, see, I think of it that way. I think what you're dealing with is you've got the elements. In this episode, Jakar is continuing his quest to find whatever happened to Mr. Garibaldi.
Mm-hmm.
And in the process of doing that, he becomes a prisoner of the Centauri. Londo, you know, now this is where their plot lines converge to a certain degree, but Jakar's story is in essence the beginning of the culmination of his spiritual journey. What he has to endure physically in order to achieve liberation, I think not only for the Narn people, but for his own spirit. But you've also got Londo, as he tells Jakar, you know, there's a monster on the throne and we need to remove him. Okay, so that's another element. We've got Delenn, who, after a very moving moment with a personal log entry from Sheridan, and we'll get to the details later, but she decides, okay, now's the time to act. You know, the League of Non-Aligned Worlds is finally dissolved, so that's not around anymore. And in essence, for the first time, she is acting of her own accord. In other words, there's no Vorlons around to guide her. She has finally shed the shadow of Dukat. You know, she's calling the shots. She's Ranger One. This is what we're doing.
Aha. That's a little bit different. You have people making decisions on their own, you know, literally standing on their own, but I don't see that as going off, you know, to be alone. They are forced to stand and make decisions without a support base that they had become used to.
Okay. Well, then, and maybe that's what I'm trying to say.
Okay.
But I guess what I'm saying is that these are all, to borrow from Delenn in the episode, people are choosing their actions. The actions are not choosing them now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Londo's
yes.
making decisions.
He's
going to overthrow. He's gonna kill Kartaja. There's just no two ways around it. But he has to do what he has to do. Okay, Jakar, he's made his decision. I mean, he knew full well what he was getting into by looking for Garibaldi. Now, whether he recognized that the path looking for Garibaldi would lead him to this, I don't think.
I don't think he thought about it at all. I honestly don't think he thought about it at all, because if he had seen any Centauri guards around, I honestly don't. It's been long enough, and he's been safe on Babylon 5. I do believe it may have slipped his mind that they were actually hunting him.
Okay. Well, okay, I'll agree with you there. And you think about his conversation with Marcus.
Mm-hmm. It didn't come up.
Right, and he was very glib about it. I mean, Marcus is like, going, you know, you're in big trouble, and he's like, well, I'm the last member of the Kari. I've seen danger. I fought the Centauri. Blah.
Yeah.
You know, he was very, very blasé about it. Okay, I'll give you that.
Yeah, it literally, it's like it didn't sink in, because he had been safe and untouchable by the Centauri as long as he was on B5. I honestly think his drive to go find Garibaldi, because he was concerned. He said, everybody's looking for Sheridan, but nobody's looking for Garibaldi. And that moment that he had with Zach just, you know, emphasized, you know, say, hey, you're not the only one worried about Garibaldi, but I can't do anything. And that's when he says, you know, I think I will.
Right.
And
right.
He was,
and I guess one
concerned.
Of the things that I remember when I first saw the episode that struck me, and this is maybe where I'm coming from with how the show changed, is that quest for Mr. Garibaldi gets derailed almost immediately. You know? I mean, it really is. It's not that it was bad storytelling on JMS's part. I was impressed by how lightning fast he made that. You know, and then of course, you know, it is. It's perfectly logical. It fits right in with the universe now, everything's set up. But that thread of Jakar looking for Garibaldi is completely derailed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and of course then we get Garibaldi in the cell.
Right.
It's just, you know, and that's a whole other thing. You know, there's another plot thread that's suddenly woven into it. We'll discuss that in a minute. There's, mm-hmm. there's just, like you said, starting off somewhere, this thing is so layered.
Yeah. And this, it's, I don't know if it was ever really touched on. Actually, I don't think it was, but it, if you go back and think about other thing that Marcus has done, I mean, think about it. Jakar got captured after Marcus left. What was the one thing that he, that just gnawed at his soul that we heard in, Ceremonies of Light and Darkness? You know, every time he walks away from something, you know, somebody happens, he doesn't listen, they get hurt, and it happens again.
Yes.
Literally,
right. Yeah.
Almost immediately after he leaves.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, one of the things that struck me in that scene, Jason Carter's performance, and it's always been there when he starts talking about these, Marcus starts talking about these very intimate things about his friends, and they keep dying. Just below the surface, you can see the pain of it all lurking there, and he's just barely keeping it at bay.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's just something, I mean, just there's some nuance in the performance that you just get the sense that the character's about ready to bust into tears. You know, but he's got to hold it together. And you're right. You know, he leaves, and almost immediately, Jakar is captured.
And you have to wonder, did any of that eat at him, knowing that mere moments after he flew his shuttle off the planet, Jakar got a beatdown and taken to Centauri
Prime? I'm sure that, I'm sorry, I'm interrupting, I apologize. That at the end of season four, when Susan's in med lab dying, that's probably as much as anything that drives, I mean, obviously he loves Ivanova, but that might be that moment where he says no more, and he turns his White Star around and heads back to Babylon 5 in the middle of the biggest fight ever. You know, he takes off.
Yep.
Because no one else is going to die on his watch. So, you know, you're right. I don't think he ever says, I left Jakar alone and he was captured and, you know, it's happening again. But I think you're right, Summer. It's just one more piece to add to his list.
But the good thing out of that is that he takes back with him information that Jakar has found about a piece of the Star Fury that Mr. Garibaldi had last been seen in. And using that information, Zach is able to, probably with a little leaked information from some other quarters, track down where exactly Mr. Garibaldi is.
Now, here's the very interesting thing.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Let's do a little thinking here.
Okay.
Okay. Garibaldi obviously doesn't like telepaths or Psi-Corp.
Oh, no.
Okay? However, there is an alliance of mutual need between at least Bester and his people and the Army of Light. Okay? The Shadows capture Garibaldi. We know that Garibaldi ends up in Bester's hands, because Bester uses him as a tool to infiltrate Eggers Industries.
Mm-hmm. Well, we don't actually know at the time that it is Bester, but we can infer from the mannerisms of the person who walked in the room.
Oh, even beyond that, I'm just saying in retrospect.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
After you've seen the series and it's played out, and you just start trying to backtrack and put the pieces together, if Bester was fighting the Shadows and what their plans were with their telepaths, why would the Shadows give Garibaldi over to Bester?
At the time, they thought they were in complete control of all of the telepaths. Their arrogance led them to make assumptions that were not true.
Maybe.
Yeah, the part that I have trouble chewing is, how did they know it was Garibaldi?
Oh, that's. I figure that's easy.
Oh,
I
yeah?
mean, he's...
Explain it to me.
Sorry? Part of it is, they captured him. They knew who he was. I mean, first of all, you know, in terms of the battle, okay, it's no secret that everybody's got a Star Fury that's decorated with their own personal pattern. So they probably sussed out it was Garibaldi. Or for that matter, you know, I mean, we know that they've infiltrated the station. So not only Mr. Morn, there's other agents on board.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So it's not a, I don't think it's a great leap for them to know who Garibaldi is and what his significance is in terms of Sheridan and his plans. Okay?
Well, no, it's not that they don't know who he is, but there's, what, 100 Star Furies out there? You're just going to send the Shadow Ship scoping out, okay? Because they're tiny compared to the spider, to the shadow crabs. They're small.
Right.
Okay, where's this one? Where's this one? I don't know. I want to know more. How'd that happen? Now,
I don't know. I guess maybe to me that's an easy
that's easier.
Logic.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they just that's just they had enough people in there to know, okay, well, who's in what Star Fury, blah blah blah. They had, you know, okay, by the way, no, maybe not. I guess that doesn't really work either, because in the heat of battle and all the battle crabs showing up, it's not like they would necessarily be in communication with anybody. I don't know. That's a good question, Summer. That's one of those dramatic moments that I just accepted at face value.
Mm.
See, to me, what's more interesting is why they would hand them. In my mind, I can't imagine that the Shadows didn't know that Bester was planning something. I mean, let's work it backwards. In Ship of Tears, Bester finds out what the Shadow shipment of telepaths are. All right, so who's to say that didn't work both ways? In other words, the Shadows and their agents in the Psi-Corps say, well, you know what? Our shipment never made it. That means somebody knew what was going on. That means it's, you know, an inside job who would be in a position to know such things. Well, you know, at that point, the path leads to Bester.
Nah, because at this point, you've got a lot of people. I mean, they know about the Rangers. They know that
right.
The Rangers are good at extricating information and smuggling at different places. That could have been intercepted by anybody. Or, you know, the information could have been intercepted. And, you know, they know Babylon 5 is becoming the hub for the resistance against them, only they haven't had a reason to really care yet because they hadn't been hurt until the battle that Sheridan arranged.
Right. So back to the point of how the Psi-Corps got a hold of Mr. Garibaldi. I mean, would you say then that the Shadows just, In their arrogance, they don't realize that they've got elements within the Psi-Corps fighting their machinations?
I do. And,
okay.
You know, for all we know, it could have been that they thought, you know, somebody in the Psi-Corps, you know, in the Psy-Cops division said, hey, we need to capture somebody from B-5's upper echelon command. When you have a chance, take it. And that was a chance.
Okay.
And because they needed somebody in a position to feed them back information and also be in a position, like, you know, we saw later, Bester did not expect Garibaldi to quit.
Right.
Which put him in the perfect position to be where Bester actually needed him to be.
Right. Right. That was an added bonus.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So his intent, I don't think his intent was actually to infiltrate Edgar's directly, but to find out information about other things that he himself would have pieced together later. And since they were on Mars, they could have sent in their own, you know, Psy-Cop strike force or whatever.
Your theory of how the Shadows got Garibaldi into the hands of Psy-Corps hangs better together than my theory. So, and mine was that perhaps having been stung so badly by what happened with Sheridan on Zahadoom that they offer Garibaldi to Bester as a peace offering.
Hmm.
In other words, here, do what you want with them, just leave us alone. And Bester's fine with that because they leave the telepaths alone, his telepaths alone, and he has an instrument of, as you say, you know, an inside job. Plus, he gets to take some measure of revenge against an individual who's given him nothing but grief.
Oh, yeah. I mean, he may see it as a way to get back at B5 for all the grief they've given him the past couple years.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Yeah. But I think your theory that they were looking for an opportunity to grab him, that was a plan that was in place. I think that probably makes more sense than mine, because one of the impressions you get from Hour of the Wolf and what happened to Mr. whatever happened to Mr. Garibaldi is that, whoop, Summer, still there?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I did something with the phone here. One of the impressions is that Sheridan's tactic with the White Star has thrown the Shadows in utter disarray. In other words, it's such an unexpected thing that they have no clue what to do next.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So, you know.
I mean, we saw that with Lita talking to Olcash.
Right.
Remember, he said, you know, what are you hiding from me? It's like, there's an opportunity here, something that we never considered.
Right.
And they are literally, hey, we can take advantage of this. What do we need to do?
Oh, hey, look what he did. Yeah. Which I think at this point leads us to the man in between.
Mm-hmm.
Between Tick and Tok.
I always loved that. It's like, you know, you're in between breaths. You're in between heartbeats. You're in between moments in time. It's frozen. You have a choice to go one way or a choice to go another way or a choice to stay.
Yeah.
You know, the three-edged sword again.
Right.
And
right.
And that's just, I don't know why, but just something about the way Wayne Alexander just delivered those lines. It's so, you get drawn in. It's like listening to a master bard tell a tale. And you're like, I was totally fascinated the first time I saw this. My brain ran amok considering the possibilities. I'm like, wait, I have to watch that again because my brain was going down tangents. What? And it was delicious.
You know, what's interesting is the layers of perception that are there. Sheridan perceives himself to be in an underground cavern somewhere lit by torches, but then there are those moments when he's suspended in space in the grasp of
something,
some entity. Yeah, and that bit where he grabs Lorien, he finally gets fed up. Pushes him against the wall. It says, "Who are you?" And Lorien just kind of opens his eyes. <You know? laughs> And then there's that moment again, you know, and the repeating question, "Who are you? Why are you here? What do you want? What do you want?" You know, and Sheridan's like, "Oh my God, whoa, wait a minute." And that's when, you know, the true reality of the situation starts sinking in. One of the things that I really, there's a number of things with that I thought was very moving. That there is an interesting irony in that the message, the private log, the personal log that Sheridan has left behind, he entered on May 14th, by the way, which is today we're recording this.
Mm-hmm.
He talks about what his father told him: when you fall off a cliff, start trying to fly. You know, why not? What do you got to lose? Okay? And that's basically, you know, don't deny what's happening around you. Surrender yourself to what's happening, and maybe something will come of it. And of course, Dolan grabs onto that as an anchor of strength when she calls for the White Star fleet to attack Zaha Doom.
Mm-hmm.
What I found interesting and ironic is when Lorien is telling Sheridan, you have to surrender and you have to let go, Sharon is going to go, I can't do it. I can't do it. It's like, wait a minute. Maybe you need to be seeing this personal log. But again, I don't think that's the inconsistency of the human condition,
mm-hmm.
and not any bad writing at all.
No, he was just saying it before.
Right.
This
that's
time
exactly it.
He's living it and he's going, oh, crap.
Yeah, right. Yeah. And then and the thing that I really find powerful, there is an element of Zen and Buddhism in that. And there's a koan, if I remember correctly, of the man who is hanging by a branch and there's an archer. You know, basically, if the man's hanging by a branch, if he lets go, he's going to fall, and the lion's going to eat him. If he hangs on, the guy with the arrow is going to shoot him. You know,
mm-hmm.
What do you do? Well, and then I think as the Cohen ends, he reaches out for a strawberry that's hanging there. And eats the strawberry. You know, he's dead anyway. He cuts it. The idea is that you just have to savor the moment.
Right.
And that's what Lorien is telling him, telling Sheridan. It's very powerful. I mean, that whole scene is just full of. It's well acted, and it's full of deep insight, and the cross cut. Where Sheridan does finally let go, and he says, "You know, what if I fall? Are you going to be there? I caught you before." And then the cross cut with Delenn looking at him.
Mm-hmm.
If you fall, I will catch you. it's amazing. It was just so incredible.
Mm-hmm.
What have you got to live for?
And then he yells it out, Delenn.
And when Lorien tells him, "I can't create life, but I can breathe life back into the embers that remain."
Mm-hmm.
Will it work? I don't know, but I can always hope.
Yep.
And what does Jakar say at the end of Zahadum? Greater than the death of flesh is the death of hope.
Yes.
Oh!
Did that one get you?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I'm sitting there going. it's just incredible. It is, I mean, it's one of those things, I was thinking about it, it's just another example of why, at that point, only JMS could write the show.
Hmm.
You know, the characters are speaking through him, and, you know, if you have a writing staff, how do you communicate? Okay, we're splitting this up. Okay, you're handling the season finale where Sheridan jumps off to his parent doom and Zaha doom. Okay, now you're going to handle this one. Okay, so write this big soliloquy as Jakari says this. Okay, now you're going to write the one where we're not sure if Sheridan's dead or alive. Okay, so you got to tie it back in, and I'm going to go off and write this other one. I mean, it wouldn't work. It just couldn't work. It had to come through the one man.
Yeah, because there are just so many nuances of character and just underpinnings of stuff that we haven't been revealed to the audience yet that needs to be in there. And I don't think at the time anybody else but him could have done that. I don't know if he had somebody along with him who was going over the scripts or anything with him each time, but it seemed like it was him and him alone. And for, what, half of season 2, all of season 3, all of season 4, that story was crystallizing in his brain. So unless they cloned his brain, we weren't going to get that story.
Exactly.
I do remember a posting on the, the news group, the rec.arts.sf.b5, mm-hmm. where he was saying, okay, I'm fed up. I can't take this anymore. You guys want the rest of season 3? Somebody send me the cheat codes to Quakery. Or it was one of those games. It was like, send me the cheat codes now or you're not getting the last 3 episodes.
Yeah. And he had them in 10 minutes.
He had them in about 4 seconds, I think.
Yeah, I'll bet. I'm sure. Let's see. What else? Oh, you know, a couple other things that...
Londo
talking about character nuance.
Mm-hmm.
The minister on Centauri Prime.
Oh.
You know, he's an apparent buffoon. And, of course, we find out what's going on with him later in The Keeper and all the rest.
Well, but I don't think that was there then. I just think that he was just completely terrified because he knows more than anybody what's going on with Cartagia. And he's... more scared than anybody because he literally is probably top of the line to get his head hacked off next.
Well, and I was going to say, yeah, that's probably right, but I was going to say there was that one hand motion when he's talking with Londo that wakes him up. And so what is the Emperor one? It's like, I don't know his mind, and he just makes that subtle gesture of his hand across
uh-huh.
his throat.
Uh-huh. He's like,
you know, and Londo gets it. It's like, mm-hmm. Hey, right, I get it. Yeah. Yeah, you're not going to say anything. And then, and that that response that Londo has when Cartagia calls him is, "You're late." Ah, well, you know, I needed to dress properly for Your Majesty. It's like, well, you know, I could have you killed, but I had your heart in mind, and if you killed me, then that would lessen you. And
it's like, I could not let you harm yourself. that was the most eloquent line of bullshit I've ever.
And what does Cartagena say? Well said.
It's like, okay, you've appealed to my vanity. I like you. You will live for now. Thank you.
Here's an interesting interesting little tidbit about that in script book number 9, which contains whatever happened to Mr. Garibaldi. JMS recounts the tale that the director at the time wanted Peter Jurecek to play it in fear of what Cartagena could do for him, do to him, and basically was trying to bullshit his way out of getting his head cut off. And Peter goes to JMS and says, well, you know what? Lana would not be that way. He's not afraid of this guy. He knows that he's bad news for the Centauri people, but, you know, he's not going to give in to him.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, JMS recounts basically that, well, you know, the thing is, on a set, you can't have the producer going behind the director and telling actors what to do because that causes chaos. But how do you handle it? So he goes, so JMS in the script book writes that he went to the director and said, I don't think Peter's giving you what you're really looking for in the scene. And the director says, you don't know. And he says, Peter, you know what? This is how you might want to think about playing it. And, you know, they ran through it. He says that, you know, the scene that we saw, that was the first take. He just nailed it. And JMS turned to the director and says, is that more what you're looking for? And the director said, yeah, exactly.
Nice.
So, and that was the thing. You know, you can tell that Londo, you know, he doesn't fear Cartagena, but he fears what he's going to do to Centauri Prime.
Yes. And that is his motivating force. And you see him when, Veer is totally, totally afraid, doesn't want to be there. He's like, no, I can't do this. And Londo's like, we have to do this for Centauri Prime. Where's your, you're a patriot. Come on. And yeah. Then when Cartagena does the, I have a gift for you, and here's your gift, and he sees Jakar, you see the wonder on his face, like he cannot believe that the universe has dropped the perfect implement for him, the missing cog for him to put all of his plans in motion. He's like,
really? See, I saw that differently.
No.
I really saw that differently.
Really?
I thought his expression was one more of, let me organize my thoughts, was that there was a certain horror in that he saw it was Jakar. In other words, and he almost says this later on in that scene in the cell, was, he's describing the torture that's going to
mm-hmm.
happen to him.
Yes.
This is what they're going to do to you. What is this what you want? He says, no, it isn't. He says, maybe one time. And he goes, no, you know what? Not even then. And I think the way I saw it was the horror of the reality. In other words, the power of the word. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Think about what Londo told Morden all those years ago, and it came true with the bombardment of Narn and the horror of that.
Right.
They had to face up to that. And this is just yet the next logical extreme in it.
Nope. Totally missed it.
Okay.
It's because you've heard him. He doesn't know. He's looking for what he knows. He needs to get rid of Cartagena before the damage to Centauri Prime is irreparable. He's brought Veer in because literally Veer is the only person he can trust. He doesn't know if there are any other Centauri he can trust to do this. And no one who is a Centauri would really truly care. And he's presented with a captive Jakar, who he knows is intelligent, strong, yeah, passionate about his people, and in a position, he's an outsider, and he's a Narn. The Centauri Royal Court's like, ah, oh, Narns, they're all stupid. They're just animals. They're a little better than, livestock. But Londo knows better. He knows different. And he's presented with Jakar, and all of a sudden, he realizes he has it's that moment, like it actually to me parallels what Lorien says. I can hope. Now he's presented with Jakar. He can actually hope to accomplish what he wants to accomplish, which is getting rid of Kartaja. By seeing okay. Jakar capture, he's like, you're gonna go through hell. They're gonna torture you. They're going to parade you around as a plaything. They will humiliate you. They will keep you alive as long as you are entertaining to them. But if you help me, I will help you. He's like, you help me kill Kartaja, I will set, you know, he's like, if that's what you want, yes. If you will help me kill Kartaja, I will help you free Narn. And literally, they're both doing this for each other, for their own people. And that look on Londo's face is one, literally, of disbelief and gratitude.
I don't know. We'll have to agree to disagree on that particular expression. I didn't see that. But I will agree with you that scene where, I mean, in the cell where Londo, you know, basically lays out the terms. Here's what's going to happen. And I love that when Jakar looks up at him and goes, "You haven't asked my price." But you're hardly in a position to bargain. And Jakar says, "Neither are you." because as much as Londo recognizes this is his chance, so does Jakar. You know, I'll do this for you, but you're going to set my people. You know, what did he say? I'll help you remove the monster on the throne, but you will remove the monster from my world.
Yes. Yeah. So like I said, they are undertaking a danger. They're literally getting ready to play a dangerous game, but they both see it as worth the risk because they're getting rid of a dire, dire threat to their own homeworlds.
Right. I know it is. It's again more layers. It's such a powerful and as obvious as the symbolism is, it is powerful when Londo opens the cell door and Jakar. After they strike the bargain, Londo has the cell door open, and the bright light hits Jakar in the face, and it's this beatific look of radiance on his face.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like yes, I see the light at the end of the tunnel.
Yes, because like literally, he is given a chance to hope.
right. Now, having said all that, there's a couple things that I have to pick a few nits with, just cause. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And these are so minor, but they just struck me. Okay, first of all, I wish there had been a better way for Lorien to express how old he was, rather than "I was old when your world was young." Cliche. I'm not a writer, so I can't really say how I would have done it differently. All right, but you know, like I said, at some point, you know, what I did like was when Sharna said, "You're one of the first ones," and Lorien's like, "No, I'm." The first one,
mm-hmm.
You know, almost offhandedly. And that was more shared and figured it out when Lorien says, you know, "I really hate seeing my children fight."
Yes. And his little metaphor, well, it's like they're younger than me. So yeah, they're my kids.
right. And that was one of the things I like, you know, Sharon's like, you don't care about this, do you? And Lorien's like, "Oh yeah, I do." You know, but he was really, you know, offhand is not the right word, but he was very non-dramatic about it. It's like, this is how the universe has been going on for aeons. You know, don't know quite else what to do about it, but here it is. The other one, and this is just, and maybe not even a nitpick, because I liked Lorien's comments about the power of words and the power of names. But every time I hear, you know, some, "Well, what's your name?" "Well, it's not important." All I think of is Slarty Barkfast. Sorry, Douglas Adams has ruined that whole thing for me. I don't know. I watched something else here recently. I don't know, going back through some old Star Trek episodes or something. It was the whole deal. "What's your name?" "Well, that's not important, Captain Picard." You know, it's like Slarty Barkfast. I told you it wasn't important. Anyway, like I say, very, very minor nits.
Minor.
You know, and really, they don't detract at all from the power of this particular episode. So there. Whew.
So you like this episode, huh?
It's a very, very powerful episode, and you know, maybe I'll back off of some of the grandiosity of my statement, but I do think that it changes the tone of the series from this point forward. It goes in different places.
Continuation of the shaking up of the snow globe.
It's not the shattering of the snow globe. It's not simply about Babylon 5. the station anymore. It's about much larger things.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, the show has always been about much larger things, but the scope suddenly widens.
Cool.
So, have we torn it all apart?
I think we have dissected and diced and sliced it as best as we can. But if we missed anything, I'm sure our lovely, lovely listeners will let us know.
We'll get all kinds of emails and voicemails. As well, they should.
Yes.
We like getting that sort of stuff. So.
Okay, we're going to take a really quick break, catch our breath, go get a shot of whiskey or something, and come back with a little bit of, tiny one email, I think.
Yeah.
Hello, this is J.C. Hutchins speaking.
Fuck you, Hutchins.
Well, hey, Sigler. Gosh, how's it going? Gee, I hope you're well.
I'm not fucking well. I'm fucking annoyed.
Well, golly, why is that?
The nominations for the Parsec Awards are coming up again.
Gosh, the Parsec Awards? You mean those Nito Keen Awards given to the year's best speculative fiction podcast?
Yeah, that's right. The fucking Parsec Awards. Anyone can nominate their favorite podcast at www.parsecawards.com. The winners are announced at Dragon Con in Atlanta, August 29th through September 1st.
Well, holy cow. When's the deadline to nominate stuff?
The nominations close at midnight on June 15th. The stories themselves had to have run between May 1st, 2007 and April 30th, 2008. Whatever kind of podcast, fiction, story, whatever people like, they can just go to ParsecAwards.com and fucking vote for it.
Wowie! Boy, I bet the Parsec Awards will really have some keen categories this year.
They've got fucking dozens of fucking categories, like best fucking short story, best fucking novella, and best motherfucking long form fiction, which is that thing that you and I do.
What? They have an award for what we do?
Fucking ain't right they do. Best long form fiction, which means best novel.
But you've never won a Parsec.
No fucking shit, you fucking jet age genius. Neither of you.
Well, the Parsec Awards.
Whoa.
Them right in their cornhole motherfucking shitting ears.
That's what I'm saying.
Stupid aardvark sucking.
Whoa.
Dick licking.
Jeez.
Camel fucking.
Holy
shit fucking ass wipes. I swear the next time I fucking hear about one of those goddamn things, I'll put that little statuette where the fucking sun don't shine.
Take a Prozac.
Shit sucking ass motherfucking dick sucking toilet paper roll.
Kiss your mom with that mouth?
Wow. Burgers.
Jeez, dude. Take it easy. It's just an award.
And we're back. We're back. We have a little bit of email, a little feedback for us.
Yeah. Just a little bit. This was a question, and I thought I'd get this out here now because it might be important for plans going forward in the future. This comes from George Brickner. He writes, "So, Summer needs minions? What does she want us to do?"
Oh.
Wow.
Wow.
Okay, let's keep it out of the gutter there, Summer.
No. I'm not sure exactly how to break down everything I do between Babylon Podcast, Slice of Sci-Fi, Ninjas, Cover to Cover, the websites for all the... I'd say 80% of the shows, the maintaining the troubleshooting, people having problems with stuff. There's just a lot to do.
I think what you really need is someone to sleep for you.
What's that? We can remember it for you wholesale.
Yes, right. Exactly.
I need a spare brain. I need a vacation is what I need. I need a vacation.
Oh, go to Hawaii.
I need a vacation and a back rub, a couple of massages, and a cabana boy.
Well,
two.
If you go to the Borg invasion, you'll get your back poked with Borg probes. I don't know if that'll be the same thing.
I don't think that's the same thing.
Okay. It was creepy.
So we should give George a big applause for the creepy Borg probes.
Yes, okay. Yes. It's very effective. Thank you, George, for that. Especially since I have a thing about needles anyway, so I was already halfway off my rocker.
And for the record, the cabana boy job has been filled. Thank you very much.
Really? It has?
Oh, yeah. I'm going to take that one.
Oh,
there's
really?
A chance to be your cabana boy. Oh, you bet, Summer. You bet.
I feel so special. Thank you.
You are special.
I will try not to leave any marks.
Whoa! yeah.
And the chat room roars.
I was going to say, I got nothing.
So yes, if I come up with some field work for Minions to do, I will give George a shout.
Absolutely, and if you have any specific talent you think might be applicable to what Summer might be looking for, feel free to get in touch with her directly. Yeah.
Now, I will eventually need wiki help because I do want to set up a very, very detailed wiki for everything Babylon 5 related and just have it associated on the Babylon Podcast website. But I have not had time to actually do anything other than download the software. So if there are any wiki wizards out there, give me a shout. Summer@sliceofsci-fi.com.
And regarding the website, I was hoping to get a couple things up because, you know, I don't know, I feel like I have been a little negligent on some things that I should be taking care of. So I was all gung-ho today to get some stuff posted up and then ran into some technical difficulties. However, even with that having said, if you're not visiting the Babylon Podcast webpage, please do so. There is a link to Adam Mojo Leibowitz's page, and he's starting a Babylon 5 blog. And his first entry has some nice behind-the-scenes shot of the initial set construction for hallways. And actually, we got an email from Mojo saying, hey, thanks. I see some people who come to my site from your site. So.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That was a good thing.
Yeah. Any chance of getting Mojo on the show?
Well, I answered his email and said, you know, are you willing to come on and talk with us? Because we'd love to have you. But I haven't heard back from him since. So maybe I scared him away.
I bet we could make that happen.
Yeah, we'll see.
So, the other thing to follow the links on is Cafe Press has extended the availability of the B5 script books until the end of June, if I recall correctly. So if you have a few spare $100 lying about that you need to spend, then head over there and fill out your collection.
Mm-hmm. And I saw something that he's also going to start putting out a volume of scripts written by other people.
Yeah, Other Voices is what it's entitled. Oh. The first one is, you know, yeah, it's got the scripts by DiTilio and I think David Gerald's script.
I need to get that.
So it looks to me like what they're going to do, all things considered, is probably make the, you know, every script available.
Eventually, hopefully.
Yeah. So.
Cool.
It'd be nice to see if it gets to Crusade. Now, Crusade has not shown up on that radar as far as I know. Something to revisit, because I talked with, and now I can't remember her name, it's killing me, the editor-in-chief over at Cafe Press for this project. She expressed a willingness to come on the show to be interviewed, but she said only after all the script books were published.
So oh, okay,
they've
cool.
They've all been published. So I'll have to dig up her email and get back in touch with her. So. And I apologize for forgetting her name. I feel really bad about that, but oh well. Just add it to my list of sins of omission.
I have a shout out.
Yes.
I know. Shout. I know. We don't. I don't know. You know. We normally don't do that sort of thing. But I got a shout out to John Lambert at the AstroCast. Astros totally wiped the Dodgers.
Yeah, well,
painful to watch. I don't know. And John, this will be an argument. I probably should just go on John's show and dig into this. But you know.
There you go.
Astro. Yeah, I know. Yeah, you guys are like, please.
We just don't want to hear you sad and crying in your cups that the Dodgers got spanked.
Yeah, that's all. We just want you to be. We want happy, Jeff.
You know, I don't think that the Astros are necessarily the better team, but boy, they sure scored more. So,
well, hey, the Orioles just swept the Red Sox in a 2-game series. So,
woohoo!
Yeah, I know. Well, weird things happen in baseball. That's what makes it so great.
It's that start of the summer. What the heck is going on? How's it going to shake out? Kind of thing.
Well, any other last last bits to toss in here before we close up?
Yes, we have a lot more people heading into Second Life to check out the feed. You can actually hear us do the live feed, so you get all of the behind-the-scenes snarkiness and innuendo and just, you know, raunchy things that we
general
say.
Rudeness.
When we're not recording, you can go to Second Life. What is that? The look for Farpoint Castle. We're right next to Third Life Books, which is Mike Stackpole's castle for selling his stuff. There's also a little pod culture tent right outside, podculture.net.
And the Astrocast bar.
That's right. We have John and they have an Astrocast bar, a saloon.
Yes.
Right outside the castle. So the links to the exact location are at the website, BabylonPodcast.com. But if you hop into Second Life and do a search for Farpoint Castle and Third Life Books, you'll find us. Also, donate. Please use the bright orange donate button on the website. Help us keep Mike's electric bill paid so we can keep recording the show.
Or at least we can start building his own nuclear reactor.
Solar power. We're in Arizona. Solar would work well.
Solar would be great. Anybody that's got extra solar panels, send them here.
There you have it. So, yeah, just donate. Click on the little button on the website. And if you want to check out Astrocast or Pod Culture, go to farpointmedia.net and check out the shows, those shows and many others.
Absolutely. We have almost as good as this one.
Almost. They're getting there, though. Well, that will do it for our show this week. I'm glad you're back, Jeffrey. We missed you.
Mahalo.
If you want to submit your own comments, feel free to send an email to babylonpodcast@gmail.com or leave us a voicemail. That number is 206-338-2259. That's 206-338-2259.
The year the Great War came upon us all.
And we'll see you next time on the other side of the volcano.